You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. When I was a little kid in the summers, my family would leave comfy suburban Omaha for the West, the real West, the old West, a day's drive out of town. We'd go to Fort Robinson in western Nebraska, where the Army had imprisoned and killed the Sioux chief Crazy Horse 80 years earlier. And then we'd go up to South Dakota, to the Black Hills. Marching around somewhere off the highway one August day in the Black Hills, we found a perfect wooden stockade made of upright, unmilled logs. Just like in the movies, it was completely thrilling, an actual fort to ourselves. From the top, we could see buffalo herds in the distance. We played for hours and hours, and I cannot remember a happier childhood afternoon. My parents didn't tell us until years later that what we'd loved so much was really a movie set, a perfect fake fort. At night in the Black Hills town of Deadwood, my parents and brother and sisters and I watched a reenactment of Wild Bill Hickok being gunned down at a card table, watched it night after night. And now I keep revisiting Deadwood every week, in fact, on HBO's new series, Deadwood.
I'm turning back slow. Nothing in hand but this whiskey bottle.
Deadwood's about that town during the South Dakota Gold Rush of 1876, and it's harrowing and funny and, I think, mostly realistic. And in theaters, at least for the moment, there's an all-star version of The Alamo, a successor to John Wayne's awful 1960 version. Maybe it's just coincidence, but it has been decades since a Western was a big deal on both the small and big screens in America. So today in Studio 360, we're asking, just how does the 19th century West figure in the popular imagination these days? My guest is the writer and scholar Rebecca Solnit. She wrote a great book called River of Shadows, Edward Muybridge and the Technological Wild West. She's traveled and lived all over the West, and she's working now on a project to re-photograph sites you've seen in pictures by Ansel Adams. Rebecca Solnit lives in San Francisco, where the Gold Rush and, by extension, the modern West began. Rebecca Solnit, welcome to Studio 360.
My pleasure.
One question that our producers kept asking here in our New York office as we were planning this show is, where exactly is the West? And I wondered how you define it, or do you define it strictly?
You know, there's an absolute for North and South, the poles. But, you know, the West does, in some sense, has always been a figment of imagination. If you're Asian, we're the Far East. If you're Mexican, we're the North. If you're Canadian, we're the South. I don't know. But it's, you know, because it's not, there's no clear and fast boundary. But I know that by the time you get to, say, Nevada, expectations about space, about time, about memory, about culture, about race are radically different than they might be in New Jersey.
You are working on a project, as I mentioned, of re-photographing Ansel Adams' pictures. Can you tell me why and how that's working?
Actually, we're re-photographing four major photographers who came to Yosemite, Edward Muybridge, Carlton Watkins, Ansel Adams, and Edward Weston. And it came out of two projects. My own work with Muybridge got me really fascinated with his Yosemite images, which are really beautiful and really disturbing and unlike anybody else's landscape photographs at the time. And so I was fascinated by these photographs, and I'd been in dialogue with the photographer Mark Klett, who was a huge help on my Muybridge book. He's been re-photographing 19th century Western landscape photographers since the 1970s. But what happened over and over is that we'd arrive at a Muybridge photograph and realize that we were 3 steps or 3 yards or 30 feet away from a Ansel Adams or an Edward Weston photograph. The place had just been mined intensively by all the major players, or, you know, these four major players in the history of Western landscape. And so you could look at Victorian landscape of, you know, these two very different types that Watkins and Muybridge were doing. You could look at high modernism, which Weston and Ansel Adams are great exemplars of, and just see in some ways that the place was really malleable, really open to be interpreted again, not as the virgin wilderness Ansel Adams wanted it to be, but as a place with a really rich, dense, complex social history and aesthetic history.
So you don't say, or the point of this project is not that the Ansel Adams depictions, which are in so many American brains, is the wrong depiction, simply one of a variety that can be made from a given place.
Yeah, and what was funny, re-photographing them, I expected that we're going to find a lot of infrastructure and things in them, and so the Ansel Adams would suddenly have parking lots in the middle of them. That didn't happen that much, although it was fascinating to find how often Ansel Adams was making what looked like a pristine wilderness photograph and was, in fact, about, 5 feet away from the road or a parking lot.
Even when he was making those pictures?
Oh, yeah. No, like one of his most famous pictures, Clearing Winter Storm, which looks like, in a landscape of God before man has been invented or something. It's all sweeping grandeur and distance and majesty. And he made that from about 5 feet below the retaining wall of the Wawona parking lot at Wawona Tunnel on the South Route Inn. The retaining wall was built by the California Conservation Corps during the Depression. It was there before the photograph was. And so it's very his pictures are just enormously selective. I think he thought he wanted to pursue a very pure kind of beauty, and he thought that these pictures of pristine stuff would inspire and motivate people to protect wilderness. And to some extent they have, and to some extent for some of us, they're still really beautiful, but they're not necessarily what we see, and we want to look at this other stuff that doesn't get shown, and we want to look at some of the complications.
Rebecca Solnit is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and we're talking about the West in the American imagination. We've all heard the plaintive cry of the steel guitar, usually in the background of songs. It comes from lightly gliding a steel bar along a set of guitar strings, and it's the signature sound of country music, from Jimmy Rogers, the singing brakeman, to Shania Twain today. When the steel guitar arrived, it moved country music from the fiddle and banjo sound of the Appalachians to the sunbelt sound of honky-tonks and truck drivers. Studio 360's David Krasnow gives us a portrait of the instrument that put the West into country and Western.
Just that sliding that string. That was the sound that grabs everybody when they hear a steel guitar, and they like that, you know.
Bill Stafford has played steel guitar for as long as there have been steel guitars. He was a little kid the first time he nudged a thin metal bar along the strings of an acoustic guitar. The technique had reached America from Hawaii.
Well, we started off when I was about 8 years old, and a man came around with a Hawaiian guitar looking for students during the Depression.
The vogue for Hawaiian guitar swept the country in the 1930s. It was just a novelty, and mostly people forgot about it. But country musicians loved the effect. They adapted it to an electric guitar that you held in your lap. You had a steel bar in your left hand to fret and slide on the strings, and you wore metal picks on your right. Artists like Hank Williams made lap steel the centerpiece of their bands. It was perfect for oil workers' honky-tonks and wistful cowboy ballads. It helped country music turn into country and Western.
And then in 53, Bud Isaacs, out of Nashville, played on a song with Webb Pierce called Slowly.
Slowly I'm falling more in love with you.
He had one pedal that pulled two strings, and this was the sound that it gave him. Like he went from a C to an F chord, all on one fret, pushing that pedal down and pulling those two strings. That song went number one in about 2 hours, as soon as somebody heard it the first time. And it sent us all scratching with our guitars. How did he do that?
The pedal under Bud Isaac's guitar shifted the pitch of certain strings, so he could change chords using his feet. It suddenly gave a new polish and sophistication to country and western. But the only guy who was making pedal steels was out in California, and when Bill Stafford called him, there was a 3-year wait.
I had to do mine. I had a double neck Rickenbacker, and I had to drill holes in the neck underneath the strings, and I'd straighten out some coat hanger wire. And I mounted a Studebaker gas pedal on a piece of plywood, and then I had screen door turnbuckles on that attached to those rods. I could push that pedal down and turn the screen door turnbuckles until it pulled the B's to a C-sharp note and raised the G-sharp's tone to an A note.
Stafford now consults for instrument builders. There's even a Stafford Elegante model sold by the Sierra Company.
It's 14 strings. It sits on a stand like a little table. And hanging down underneath the guitar, you have knee levers that you work with your knees, and you push them up and to the left and to the right. So just about every part of your body you use to play this thing.
You know, when you listen to country music and you hear what appear to be fairly simple lines or simple lyrical things coming out of the steel guitar, the guy that's playing it is doing a whole choreography and acrobatics to make that sound happen.
Chaz Smith played synthesizer until one encounter with the pedal steel changed his life.
At the time, I used to drink a bit. And I was on the floor of the apartment, and the wife and the friends were going out somewhere to get something. I don't know what it was, and I couldn't move, and I was just lying there. And one of the friends had left a recording of Waylon Jennings' Honky Tonk Heroes on the turntable, going over and over and over, and I can't get up to take it off. And so I'm lying there on the floor listening and listening and listening. And Ralph Mooney is playing on this Waylon Jennings record. And the sound that came out of that steel guitar was raw, but with emotion. And it just captured me. And it kept playing. And I couldn't get it to shut it off. And the more I listened to it, I'm like, God, what is that sound? In 1978, I went out and bought one and started the odyssey of learning how to play it. Probably the best thing I ever did.
Smith loves to play Western swing, but mostly he records his own compositions. He's taken steel guitar to a new territory of ambient sonic shapes.
It's like looking at a tapestry where it just kind of hangs in the air, and you can see the interplay of all the layers and all the details, and there's like a lot of stuff in there to look at.
The pedal steel is entirely metal on metal. The strings, the finger picks, the bar, the machinery. Your skin doesn't really touch it. The brightness can be glaring, with overtones shimmering like mirages. Using the volume pedal under your right foot, you can keep a note floating in the air for days. Chad Smith says the long sustains of pedal steel resemble the wide open spaces of the Western landscape.
I grew up on the East Coast, and when I came out to the West, I was struck by the distance. When I was coming through, particularly New Mexico and Arizona, I could see mountain ranges that were 60 miles away. So that long distance, those long lines, and you could see what I was thinking of is like time between here and there. That's an hour away. You know, you can see time, you can see length, you can see units, you can see space. The music that is evocative of that are long tones, single events, and color, you know, long colors that overlap and interplay and that kind of stuff.
For Studio 360, I'm David Krasnow.
I think it's just a beautiful sound, and it's hard to describe something you like. You know, it's like telling somebody what color something is.
I'm Kurt Anderson, talking about the West today with Rebecca Solnit. Rebecca, what do you think of the pedal steel guitar?
Sounds great to me.
Yeah, me too.
I love that sound.
I do too. And I even though I was raised in Nebraska to despise country and Western music, part of my own teenage rebellion was to embrace it and love it, and it was exactly that sound that made me fall in love. Do you listen to country and Western music, Rebecca?
Yeah, I make compilation tapes I listen to. It's funny because I had the same experience. I grew up, you know, my parents are from, well, one's from New York, one's from L.A., but I was brought up to think that country and Western was kind of stupid and kind of sappy and stuff, and I had a sort of total immersion revelatory experience when this Native American World War II vet named Bill Rossi pulled out a guitar and sang about 2 hours of Hank Williams and Johnny Cash, and it was clearly the next place for me to go after punk rock. And it had the same kind of toughness and rancor and grievous bodily destruction, death, and despair. And it was very tough, intense, and often really beautiful music. And one of the things that's always fascinated me and moved me and made me really connect to it is that all those stories are kind of about human relationships falling apart in loneliness and heartbreak and, you know, she left me for another and all this stuff. But there's always, as a background, a sense of landscape that doesn't go away, that doesn't abandon you, that isn't fickle. And there's a real passion for place, for geography, for home, for rivers, for roads, for highways, and for using them as kind of metaphors for understanding the human psyche, too, in that music. And that's, I think, a lot of what I connect to is that powerful commitment to place in the music, as well as the high, lonesome sound.
It's also interesting, which I didn't know, that it's a relatively recent technological innovation, which is also makes it, it seems to me, a very Western American thing, that this old-fashioned-seeming sound is produced by something that was made up 70 years ago.
Well, I also like the idea that it came from Hawaii. Nobody quite figured out what to do, and then it settled down as sort of a Western sound. I think the West is so often not about what was generated here, but what found a home here, and it sounds like pedal steel is part of that. We usually think of the West as being kind of authentic and rugged and manly and the opposite of technology, but it was always about technology.
Rebecca Solnit is my guest today. We're talking about the sounds and sights and history and fantasies of the West. In a minute, it's Clint Eastwood in a poncho.
Oh, boy.
Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Dusty skies, I can't see nothing inside.
Ah, Tommy.
Good old Dan, you'll have to guide me right. If we lose our way, the cattle will stray, and we'll lose them all.
Funding for Studio 360 is provided by Volkswagen of America and the Phaeton, a new kind of luxury car from Volkswagen. More information about the Phaeton's 335-horsepower V8 engine or 4-zone climate control system can be found at VW.com. And by The Economist, featuring weekly book reviews and global arts coverage on newsstands and on the web at economist.com/books. Funding for Studio 360 is provided by Nonesuch Records, now featuring A Foreign Sound, the first English-language album by Brazilian singer Caetano Veloso, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with Rebecca Solnit, and we're talking about the culture of the West. And there is no cultural genre more Western than the Western. A friend of mine was once in a college film class for a screening of The Magnificent Seven, which is John Sturges' 1960 tale of beleaguered Mexican peasants who hire a team of unemployed gunfighters to save them from bandits. But because of a mix-up, the film that came on was in Japanese. It was The Seven Samurai, Akira Kurosawa's 1954 movie. That mix-up was kind of appropriate, because Kurosawa's samurai were inspired by the principled stoic gunfighters in John Ford movies. And John Sturges modeled his movie on Kurosawa's, with Mexican villagers instead of Japanese. Directors all over the world have made Westerns, in fact, and some of them have used the genre in very different ways than Americans. The so-called spaghetti westerns, imported from Italy, found a passionate following in this country starting in the 1960s. Sir Christopher Frayling, the biographer of the spaghetti western director Sergio Leone and film collector Ali Lamage, explain the appeal.
The Italian westerns have been called an opera in which the arias aren't sung, they're stared.
I don't think it's nice, you laughing.
The bad guy is the good guy, the anti-hero.
You see, my mule don't like people laughing. He gets the crazy idea you're laughing at him. Now, if you apologize, like I know you're going to, I might convince him that you really didn't mean it.
They felt like an Italian take on an American myth.
They were funded by Italians, made by Italians.
Roman musicians doing the scores. The locations were in southern Spain, usually an American playing the lead.
The spaghetti westerns itself, actually, they started in 1960.
A trickle of films was made in Italy, which pretended to be American westerns for the benefit of Italian audiences who would think they were American. And they were really carbon copies of American B-movies and television westerns, with titles like Buffalo Bill, Hero of the Far West. But breakthrough year was 1964, when Sergio Leone's film Fistful of Dollars came out.
Aim for the heart or you'll never stop me.
This man with no name is played by Clint Eastwood. He's going to trigger a whole new style in adventure.
You go, whoa, wait a minute. Wow, this is something new.
You identified with him because he looked great. And between 1964 and 1972, nearly 400 westerns were made in Italy and Spain, at a time when Hollywood was producing maybe 10, 15 a year.
They were very popular. You had a huge audience, especially in the Italian neighborhood. They used to be sold out. Fal Fornum used to be sold out. You could stand in room only.
It was extraordinary, this kind of explosion, this gold rush of westerns which happened. And it was basically to feed a market which wanted to see cowboy films, and Hollywood wasn't making them anymore.
Some of the titles are fantastic. One Damn Day at Dawn, Django Meets Sartana. It's like, okay, I could see that one. I mean,
A Man Called Sledge.
Bullet and the Flesh.
A Minute to Pray, A Second to Die.
Take a Hard Ride.
The Man Called Noon.
Sabata's Back.
Wow, this is great. I mean, you know, it was, as a kid growing up, they were very violent. A lot of bodies flying all over the place.
Death rides a horse.
It was an atmosphere that was spot on for the mid-1960s. And it struck a chord when they were released in the States in 1968. I remember going to see a triple bill of Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More and The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, Leone's great trilogy, in San Francisco. And I was in an audience of people who'd either been to Vietnam or were about to go to Vietnam or were students protesting about Vietnam. And there was a scene in The Good, the Bad and the Ugly where there's a battle in the American Civil War that is completely pointless. And the Clint Eastwood character says, I've never seen so many men wasted so badly.
Never seen so many men wasted so badly.
And the entire cinema erupted into cheering and shouting and all the rest of it.
The rest of the world saw United States completely different because they said, okay, here's a country. This is how violent that country has always been.
What he was doing was just picking up on things that were in the ether in the modern city, I think. I don't think it was intended as a commentary on American values. I don't think Leone would have felt capable of doing that. It wasn't his place.
I mean, what do you want? They don't know. They didn't go by how authentic the West was. They couldn't because they've never seen the West.
The main issue is the morality of Hollywood films, the crusading element, the John Wayne-type character. This the Italians didn't like. They're a bit more anarchic. There aren't black hats and white hats. There's grey hats. Streetwise, grown-up, modern people in the Wild West, rather than the traditional sort of chivalric hero.
Once upon a time...
Once Upon a Time in the West is probably the finest spaghetti western film ever made.
It had Henry Fonda as the bad guy. Of course, you have to cast against type, so he plays a psychopathic murderer.
You know, here's Henry Fonda. I mean, he just killed the whole family.
And Charles Bronson plays the silent avenger, the man with no name, the sort of Clint Eastwood part.
The man in search of a name.
It's the ultimate movie about westerns, and it was a critical and commercial disaster.
Now they consider it a classic film.
Time magazine called it Tedium in the Tumbleweed because it lasted very long and it's very slow in pace. It's very balletic. It was a kind of funeral dirge for the Hollywood Western. C'era una volta il West, which means in English, once upon a time, there was the West. But it was translated as Once Upon a Time in the West. And I think Leone's debate is with film history. He makes sense as someone who comments on Hollywood. They're films about films. You know, Leone called it cinema, cinema. The Western is a global text now. Who owns the Western? Discuss.
Sir Christopher Frayling, who's a scholar of spaghetti westerns. We also heard from Ollie Lamage, whose company Wild East Productions releases spaghetti westerns today on DVD. That piece was produced by Jonathan Mitchell. I'm Kurt Anderson today with the writer Rebecca Solnit. All right, Rebecca, discuss, Sir Christopher said. Do you like those movies?
I adore them. I love the Clint Eastwood spaghetti westerns. Who can resist all that vast space and really cool guys and, unimaginably fabulous shooting and, great plot line, all that stuff. Although it's funny, I finally saw The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which I had seen about 8 million times on late night TV in hotels and motels and on the road. I finally saw it on the big screen in San Francisco at one of our beautiful old movie theaters, the Castro, 40 feet wide. And what was shocking seeing it that big is when you see it that big, you can see that the plants aren't Western plants. There's a scene where these campesinos are eating off earthenware dishes that just look really Italian or Spanish. And, everyone in John Wayne movies is eating off tinware. And just all the details felt really off, so it felt even more displaced. But I completely agree with Sir Christopher Frayling that just as the blues became music that was no longer about the Mississippi Delta or the South, but just became how you thought about Harpwake and Buenos Aires or, Finland, so Western movies became a style of expressing masculinity and power and violence that isn't necessarily rooted in the West anymore.
Well, and we know that in Germany, for instance, is full of these clubs of people who spend their time dressing up as Indians and trappers and cowboys and cavalry officers to sort of play out their reenactors' love of this Western myth, which is very odd.
Well, with the Germans, you have to remember it doesn't come out of the movies. It comes out of the 19th century German novelist Karl May, who Vladimir Nabokov also loved. And one of the things I've always wanted to track down and write more about is Indians in Europe. One of James Joyce's stories in The Dubliners opens with kids playing cowboys and Indians. Mm-hmm. And it's, not really how we think of James Joyce, but it's really about how by the beginning of the 20th century, cowboys and Indians are really present even in Europe. And, of course, Buffalo Bill's Wild West Circus and a number of the other ones were touring Europe, and that imagery was really pervasive.
Well, that's amazing, isn't it? The fact that Wild Bill, or Buffalo Bill rather, had the cowboy show pretty much in real time as the West was still extant, and he was creating an entertainment around it, I find so amazing, Ed, that these dime novels about the West were being produced in the West at the time. The fact that in this country the mythologizing was happening even as the real life was being lived is kind of amazing.
Yeah. I once had a lot of fun writing a couple essays for a very Western art magazine called Art Issues based in L.A., claiming that postmodernism wasn't invented by academics and theorists in the late 20th century. It was invented by cowboys and Indians in the 19th century West. You just have these bizarre things. Buffalo Bill's circus reenacted the Battle of Little Bighorn and things like that. Sitting Bull joined the circus for a couple seasons and sold signed photographs of himself. And, can you imagine an outlaw? Can you imagine one of the leaders of the Viet Cong entering a circus and selling signed pictures of himself to Americans. And it's just not really the way we think things work, but it's exactly the way things work. And so that fluidity of moving from actuality to its representation, and which is really so often its dramatic, highly embroidered misrepresentation, is really quintessentially Western. And I think in some ways you can see it also in someone like Ronald Reagan, who couldn't tell the difference between fact and fiction. And, came out of Hollywood, which really, I think, invented his psyche in some profound ways.
Our current president obviously loves using the language and imagery of Western movies, you know, Wanted Dead or Alive. I recall him saying at one point a couple of years ago, and smoke them out of their holes and all that kind of thing. That is very much a kind of reinvention, self-reinvention of the kind that you're saying the West is uniquely capable of producing.
Let me be unkind in a really Western way. Acting like a cowboy is one way to be a criminal, and lying is a long Western tradition. And I think George Bush is really good at both of those things.
So I thought you were going to say all hat and no cattle, but you're going well beyond that.
Yeah. I am.
Are cowboys, you've lived in the West, all over in places like New Mexico and spent time in Nevada. Are ranchers and cowboys in real life in 1998 and 2004 like we imagine them from our various sets of imageries, from Marlboro ads to John Wayne movies?
Oh, yes and no. There's definitely some cowboys who fit in the Marlboro ad thing, probably right down to the lung cancer. But actually, the ranch I've spent the most time on is run by two Western Shoshone elders, Carrie and Mary Dan, who are fighting the U.S. over the fact that, you know, what the government says is federal land is really Western Shoshone land. And their main cowboy was a Mexican who didn't speak English named Jesus. And I always loved it. They had Jesus on their side. He was an extraordinary horseman. And a lot of what cowboys came out of was the Latino-Mexican West. That's where you get the boots, the spurs, the chaps, the high-pommeled saddles, the horseman's skills. And, a lot of them were Mexican again. And those are the guys who are wearing cowboy hats and really identifying in some ways. But there are cowboys out there, and a lot of them are not boys, and a lot of them are not white, but they're out there.
Rebecca Solnit is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and we're talking about the West in the American imagination. We wanted the poet and novelist Sherman Alexie to weigh in on the West for us. He grew up on the Spokane Indian Reservation in Washington State and wrote a collection of stories called The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fistfight in Heaven. We asked Alexie to read something he'd written that would shed light on our myths of the West, and he gave us an unpublished poem called My Architect. I asked him why this poem evoked the West for him.
As an Indian and as an Indian writer, I always find it ironic, contradictory, whatever, that I write a lot of poems lamenting the loss of salmon for my tribe, but I write it on computers powered by electricity, powered by the dams that took the salmon away. For me, my relationship with nature, my relationship with the idea of the West is contradictory. It contains multitudes, and I think I try to talk about those complications in this poem. My architect. During the night, a spider built its web in and around our mailbox. I search for the thing, hoping it doesn't have a red hourglass on its belly, before I reach into the box, brushing aside the web, breaking the hole into fine, sticky threads, and pull out catalogs, postcards, ads, dead letters, bills, sweepstakes, all the evidence of an ordinary life. This happens every morning for a week. I destroy what the spider creates. Human sadness and spider sadness, my joy and its joy, are alien emotions. The unseen spider might be incapable of grief at this destruction. It might never weep or mourn its losses. Does this spider need to celebrate the daily construction and reconstruction of its web, its home, its killing floor? I only ask these questions because I want to confess and atone for the small sin of valuing my life more than the life of this nameless spider who rebuilds its damn web for 7 nights. This 8-legged architect, street fighter, union worker, and guerrilla soldier will not surrender to me. I admire this spider. Though what I see as boldness is likely the dumb instinct to survive and replicate, to give birth, to mother hundreds of children, to construct these webs, each one identical to the others, to repeat, 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 until death. On the 8th morning, the spider is gone. Briefly, I grieve this loss, and am surprised, briefly, by my grief, before I return, return, return to my dumb and brief life. I think when I wrote the poem, what I was struggling against was sort of the stereotyping of me as a native writer. The idea that I'm supposed to be an environmentalist, that I'm supposed to be writing nature poems. Even when I was growing up in the woods, on the res, with an outhouse until I was 7, I dreamed about the city. So I think its original intention was just to fight against those expectations of me. My idea of who I was as an Indian never fit with the mass culture's idea of being Indian. I mean, there's Indians always on TV. Right now, you know, there's 100 channels on my cable system. I'm sure if I flipped through the channels at this very moment, I'd find 7 shows that had an Indian in it. And 6 of them would be in loincloths. And the 7th would be a wise old grandfather getting a vision somewhere. So I grew up with that, but I didn't identify with it because it wasn't me. I was a Spokane Indian boy and, you know, Sears Tough Skins and Chuck Taylor tennis shoes, watching Nova and the Brady Bunch. In terms of the mythology of the West, I think about my poetry editor, Bob Hirshon, who's a Jewish guy who grew up in Brooklyn, who once wrote a poem about sitting at a conference in Salt Lake City, and everybody was talking about the idea of the West. What is the idea of the West? What does the East think of the West? And Bob's reply is, the East doesn't think about the West at all. You know, we're obsessed with our self-identity out here, and probably nobody else is.
The funny and thoughtful writer Sherman Alexie with his fresh example of Western literature. I'm Kurt Anderson today with Rebecca Solnit, talking, at least on my part, from the East about the West. Sherman Alexie was talking there, I thought, quite eloquently about those real contradictions and complications, that being a Native American doesn't mean you don't love the electricity for your computer.
Yeah, and it also sounds like he's trying to move towards something more sophisticated and useful than purity. You don't have to be pure to not love the dams and love the salmon. You know, you can also acknowledge that you're complicit. You don't have to think Yosemite is a virgin wilderness rather than a stolen homeland with a lot of parking lots in it to look at the waterfalls as well as the parking lots. And I think that the histories we're moving towards are histories that are much more inclusive, not only in a sort of politically correct, nice to everyone, but inclusive of the complications and the gray areas and the moral ambiguities and the unheard voices and the recovered stories and some of the really hilarious ironies. And that is a much more exciting history than the John Wayne, Ronald Reagan history of the West.
My guest is Rebecca Solnit. More Western art in a minute, but nothing to do with cowboys or Indians. We're going to travel 100 miles from nowhere to visit a concrete monument to the heavens. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Funding for Studio 360 is provided by The Economist, featuring weekly book reviews and global arts coverage on newsstands and on the web at economist.com/books. And by Nonesuch Records, now featuring A Foreign Sound, the first English-language album by Brazilian singer Caetano Veloso, available at tower.com/nonesuch. ¶¶ Studio 360 is brought to you by Powell's Books, an independent bookseller since 1971, now celebrating 10 years online, featuring exclusive author interviews and essays, uncensored book reviews, and more on the web at powells.com.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and my guest today is Rebecca Solnit, who writes about the history of technology and culture and the West. America itself was the West, the great land of liberty and opportunity to Europeans for two centuries before we ever heard the phrase, "Go West, young man." Going West has always meant reinventing oneself, starting fresh with a big blank slate. That's been true of artists as well as entrepreneurs. In the 1960s, a group of smart young sculptors rejected the gallery scene of New York City to create works in the deserts and mountains of the West. They traded paintbrushes and palette for bulldozer and crane and became known loosely as earthworks artists. The works can't travel, and they're mostly pretty hard to get to. Jenny Brundin of KUER in Salt Lake City took a long drive to a high basin near the ghost town of Lucen, Utah, to visit Nancy Holt's sun tunnels.
Over there are the Ortiz Mountains, and that's Cerro Pelon. That smaller mountain there that's very close by.
When artist Nancy Holt looks out over the rolling landscape outside her house in Galisteo, New Mexico, she sees a vineyard in the distance and the muted greens and browns of juniper, cactus, and Russian olives, maybe a coyote or two.
And they howl a lot, and they run in the arroyo that's right next to my property, or on my property, I shouldn't say next.
The landscape is beautiful, but it's not where Holt wants to create art. She prefers crafting works from the desolate saline earth in places like the valley west of the Great Salt Lake, near the Nevada border. Land so flat, you can see the curvature of the earth. It's where she produced her 1976 earthwork, The Sun Tunnels.
So if we had binoculars, we should be able to see sun tunnels from here.
Land art enthusiasts like Hikmet Lowe, a Salt Lake librarian, are happy to travel the bumpy dirt road to the remote sun tunnels. And the journey there, says Nancy Holt, is meant to be challenging.
Part of the experience of the work is seeing it from afar, because the desert is so vast that you can make a rather large work and have it look like a little dot on the landscape from 4 miles away.
Aha, yes. Yeah. See them?
They're
peeking
out right there.
Yep. Wow.
But the thrill is seeing it from 4 miles away. As you're approaching it, one tunnel will cover up another, or the configuration will be confusing.
And now it just looks like the two of them, the ones in the center, are gone.
And then as you approach, you start to see the configuration, and then you can walk over and actually become part of it and get inside of it.
Is it nice and warm?
Oh
my God, it is.
The sun tunnels are four concrete tubes, each 9 feet wide, 18 feet long, each weighing 20 tons. They're arranged in an X shape on a flat, sun-baked valley ringed by mountains and heat-fueled mirages. When Holt was designing the sun tunnels, she found an astrophysicist at the University of Utah to calculate the angles of the solstices, taking into account the contours of the Earth, so that on solstices, the sun, as it rises and sets, is perfectly centered through the ends of the tunnels. Looking through the tunnel to the northeast, there's a rocky, barren peak. Looking southeast, gleaming salt flats, and the tunnel facing southwest, snow-capped mountains. Hikmet Lowe.
It's that sense of enclosure. It's that sense of, I'm part of this landscape, and these pieces are helping to define me within this landscape. They're helping to give it a shape and a resonance that obviously I wouldn't be having if they weren't here.
Holes are cut into the top halves of the tunnels, corresponding to constellations, so the sun sends disks of light dancing across the bottoms of the tunnels as time passes.
So it's really fascinating having day and night inversed and the sun causing the reflection down here of supposed stars in the daytime. You're walking on the stars.
Before she set foot in Utah, Holt was showing her work in New York galleries. But she and some of her friends began seeing art as over-commercialized and museums as emblems of authority. In the summer of 1968, Holt, her husband Robert Smithson, and Michael Heiser flew to Las Vegas. They rented a car, and Holt entered the desert for the first time.
I had a very powerful experience of feeling that the desert and my inner landscape were identical. It was an incredible, very timeless moment.
Out west, they found what Earth artist Michael Heiser called that kind of unraped, peaceful, religious space artists have always tried to put in their work. They headed into the dry lake beds of Nevada, where Holt photographed as the others dug trenches for Heiser's work Nine Nevada Depressions, a 520-mile line linking nine sites of troughs, loops, and intersections. The trio headed up to Mono Lake in California, collecting and shipping 18 crates of rocks and stones back to Smithson's Greenwich studio for his gallery piece, Mono Lake Nonsite. It was on this trip, says Holt, that the Earthworks movement crystallized. Everything opened up, she says. There was a whole new world before her.
The landscape was so spectacular, and there was so much endlessness and infinity and universality in the Western landscape. The sky was so extraordinary with all of the stars being visible, stars that I had never seen before on the East Coast because of the climate there and because of the pollution.
Earthwork artists were also influenced by minimalism with its geometric, pristine, simple lines. Hikmet Low.
It was just a pretty simple leap to go from the straight lines of cubes within galleries and gallery walls and translate those lines into the out-of-doors, to be able to take those simple lines, such as Walter DeMaria, such as Michael Heiser, Robert Smithson, and certainly Nancy Holt, and create works that are based on simple line shapes out on a canvas that's enormous.
In 1969, The Whole Earth, the first photograph of Earth from space, transfixed the world and gave artists like Holt the sense that the planet was finite, ripe for artistic exploration and reflection. The Whole Earth shot also helped connect the scientific to the spiritual. Nancy Holt made the sun tunnels to give the viewer an awareness of her place in the landscape and in the universe.
You needed to have this openness so you can see the sun rising and setting on the solstices and get that sense of being on the planet, moving in space, the cyclical time of the sun, which is so ever-present in the desert, but it really isn't something you're as aware of when you live in a city.
Holt once compared the sun tunnel site to a line from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, "Dawn points and another day prepares for heat and silence." For Studio 360, I'm Jenny Brundine.
You can see some pictures of Nancy Holt's sun tunnels at our website, studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson, today with the writer Rebecca Solnit. It does strike me in all that I've seen of that work that it, for me, it's where minimalism of that era of the late 60s and 70s really found its stride and its kind of proper medium and its power. I was never much for minimalist sculpture in galleries, but those things seem to have an incredible kind of just sheer spectacular voltage.
It's also interesting, Nancy and Robert Smithson were New Jersey kids who came west to find sort of real scope for their expression and literally places big enough where you could do this kind of thing. And the world's really shifted a lot from that kind of earth art to doing stuff that's more about restoration and maybe not such a radical alteration of an existing landscape. But the things they did are magnificent.
It has shifted, and I know that's more politically correct. But do we miss something by not having that kind of heroic manipulation of landscape?
Well, we do have it with, you know, incredibly beautiful freeway overpasses. We have massive engineering projects, some of which are kind of beautiful. I can think of a few freeway overpasses I really like, some of which are horrendous, like the bomb craters of the Nevada test site, the railroad trestles that were built in the 19th century and railroad tunnels and things like that. You know, and the earthworks were also a really interesting commentary on a landscape that was already gouged and rearranged and controlled in some ways.
For more than 100 years now, people have been decrying the closing of the frontier and the end of the free and untrammeled Wild West. Are we going to keep doing that as Americans, or are we over that now? And in the next century, we'll find something else to be rueful about.
I mean, the question is, so who was Rufo? And Frederick Jackson Turner wrote that Closing of the Frontier thesis in 1892. The Indian Wars weren't really over. I mean, where the hell is the frontier if you're a Lakota or a Shoshone? And, you know, it is also a very masculine fantasy about a discovery and conquest and contact and, you know, those damn virgin landscapes and stuff. You know, and there's a sort of almost erotic fantasy of virgin wilderness, of wanting to be the first foot ever to step on whatever that's, you know, wanting to deflower the virgin that's the landscape.
Or to keep it virginal.
Yeah, or to keep it virginal. But not that long ago, you still heard men all the time talking about, we must have been the first people ever. Oh, I was the first one on top of that peak, which often involved powerful amnesia. But I don't think women have quite the same fantasies about defloration and conquest. I really don't. You know, it doesn't mean that we're pure and wonderful. We have our own special sins. I'm sure Schumann and Alexei and I could go into in great detail for some other program you do. But I think that is not one of ours.
Rebecca Solnit, thank you for joining me today in Studio 360.
My pleasure.
Rebecca Solnit has been my guest. She is the author of River of Shadows, Wanderlust, and several other fascinating books. You can find out more about her and all the stories you heard today at studio360.org.
On the sunny side of the Rockies, where the desert.
During the last couple of years, I've noticed that more and more of the movies that really surprised and thrilled me have been foreign. Then, just the other day, I noticed that three of the very best movies in theaters right now are also foreign.
Und jedenfalls, mir fällt keine bessere Familie ein als unsere.
Goodbye, Lenin, about a son and mother in East Germany during the collapse of communism.
Alex?
Und wir lieben dich alle.
Alex?
Was ist denn?
Was ist denn das?
Osama, about a girl and her mother in Afghanistan under the Taliban. And I'm Not Scared, about a little boy and his mother and father in rural 1970s Italy.
Una grotta piena d'oro e di pietre preziose.
At this particular worrisome moment, when it seems like America and half the world are engaged in intensifying mutual fear and loathing, I thought, hey, great. At least high-end movie audiences aren't insular and complacent and xenophobic. They have all these great cinematic windows into places and people elsewhere on the planet. But I'm afraid this hopeful glimmer was dashed when I read an article in the Los Angeles Times about how just 1.5% of movies in American theaters today are foreign language, and just 3% of serious novels are translations, and that even in the most universal language, music, only 8% of CDs sold here are by foreign performers. In other words, without any government censorship, our free culture is as resistant to outside cultural influence as the most regressive, repressive, paranoid third world countries. It wasn't always this way. In the late 1950s and early 60s, cool films by the new generation of French directors like Truffaut and Godard were thrilling American audiences.
Pourquoi tu n'aimes pas la musique?
Ça dépend, c'est.
In order to be a culturally literate person back then, you had to see them.
Italia.
And then, suddenly, U.S. readers discovered Jorge Luis Borges and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and the explosion of Latin American fiction began. Then came the great world music boom in the 80s. And then, sometime in the 80s, this eager international connoisseurship by educated Americans effectively came to an end. How come? Well, after the Vietnam War, as we shook off our national guilt and self-doubt and malaise, even the cultural elite lost its taste for the stories being told by artists abroad. Even if we weren't Reaganites, we started celebrating American things again. And a new generation of quirky, independent American filmmakers were making challenging movies that took the place of the Truffauts and Fellinis and Bergmans in art house theaters and on college campuses. I hope that this closing of the American mind has now gone about as far as it can go, and that now the cycle can shift. The pendulum will swing back. There are two reasons each of us ought to do our part. First is all the amazing, enlightening, entertaining stuff from abroad that is just passing us by. The other reason to include a few more foreign movies and novels in our cultural diets is because there's no faster way to get a vivid sense of how other people are thinking and dreaming and living these days. And if we want to figure out why so many people in other countries hate us and maybe convince them to hate us less, shouldn't we try to understand them first? People are worried right now about outsourcing in this globalized era, how American manufacturing and service jobs are moving overseas. But maybe we owe it to ourselves to do a little more outsourcing when it comes to culture. To see the movies and read the novels and listen to the music created in and about places that aren't America. This is Kurt Anderson, and you've been listening to Studio 360.
Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Lital Mulad,
Michelle Siegel,
David Krasnow,
Abe Carrillo,
Jonathan Mitchell,
Sarah Lilly,
Benjamin Shaw,
Eric Malinsky.
Our theme music was composed by David Van Tegum. Last week's story about Diamanda Galas was produced for us by Trey Kay.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, and by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, accelerating entrepreneurship across America. On the web at kauffman.org. Additional support is provided by Volkswagen of America and the Phaeton, a new kind of luxury car from Volkswagen. More information about the Phaeton's 335 horsepower V8 engine or four-zone climate control system can be found at vw.com. And by Powell's Books, an independent bookseller since 1971, now celebrating 10 years online, featuring exclusive author interviews and essays, uncensored book reviews, and more on the web at powells.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360,
a
musician uses your cell phone conversations as his raw material.
I can't deny that the first time I began listening to people's conversations, it does alter you, because you enter into an imaginary world that is real.
The Art of Watching. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.